Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we sift through stacks of information and give you the shortcut to being truly well-informed. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are undertaking a comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed analysis of one single high-stakes source, The Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, October 29th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Astor. Our mission today is really to extract the most important nuggets from the day's reporting, focusing on those big shifts, the tectonic movements in global tech, geopolitics, and the pressing issues facing the domestic U.S. economy. We're aiming to synthesize what all these seemingly disparate threads mean when you weave them together.
And the thread that just leaps off the page today is the rapid, almost structural change being driven by artificial intelligence. So we're starting right there with a deep dive into the AI economy. This sector isn't just about, lines of code anymore. It's driving these massive corporate restructurings, huge valuations, and some deeply human changes in the job market. Let's unpack the high stakes legal and financial maneuvering right at the top, starting with OpenAI and Microsoft.
Yeah, what's really fascinating here is the successful conversion of OpenAI's main for-profit subsidiary into a public benefit corporation, a PBC. Now, this wasn't just some, administrative box ticking. It actually clears a major structural hurdle that's been looming over the company. Specifically, it smooths the path for a potential IPO, an initial public offering, and really streamlines their ability to raise huge amounts of capital and, importantly, attract top-tier talent.
Right. And that structural shift had these immediate massive ripple effects. We saw Microsoft, their longtime partner and biggest investor, see its valuation pushed above, an astonishing $4 trillion mark on the news. This PBC structure, it seems like a really interesting legal tool trying to kind of square the circle between hypergrowth and, an altruistic mission.
It absolutely is. It's kind of a new model taking shape. And the valuation specifics, they tell a really powerful story about how mission and money are being balanced, or maybe rebalanced, I should say. The new structure gives OpenAI's original nonprofit parent a pretty substantial stake in the new for-profit entity, and it's already valued at a staggering $130 billion. And crucially, the agreement includes a mechanism, a way for the nonprofit to actually gain more ownership as the for-profit side gets more valuable. The idea is to ensure the mission stays paramount, at least in principle.
And this whole thing caps off nearly a year of really tense legal and, frankly, political wrangling, didn't it? Yeah. They had to deal with the attorneys general of both California and Delaware, who, have the power to regulate nonprofits in their states. Mm-hmm. Plus, there were these internal concerns from the wider philanthropic community and key investors asking, could this AI giant truly stay true to its founding mission while basically turning into a conventional corporation built for capitalization?
Oh, the tension was definitely culpable. And you have to remember the external pressure, too. There's the ongoing litigation from Elon Musk's XAI and others who were arguing that OpenAI had strayed dramatically from its original nonprofit path in pushing for this for-profit conversion. Now, with the PBC structure in place, the way forward is, clearer, even if the lawsuits continue. For the first time, they have a corporate form that explicitly acknowledges that tension between maximizing shareholder returns and maximizing public benefit.
And speaking of Microsoft, they own a pretty significant chunk of this new entity. I found it fascinating that their CEO, Satya Nadella, described his mindset as all platform. Now, after years of what seemed like intense internal sparring over control, what prompted that sudden strategic shift at Microsoft? Yeah. Moving from wanting tight control to this vision of being an open platform hosting everyone.
It's really a move towards strategic resilience, I think. Microsoft owns 27% of this new public benefit corporation. Plus, they retain exclusive IP rights to OpenAI tech until 2032. And OpenAI is also buying another, $250 billion worth of Microsoft's Azure cloud services. The money they put in, $13.75 billion since 2019, it's increased in value nearly tenfold. But yeah, the dynamics have shifted. Nadella seems to realize that sole control is maybe less valuable than being the central, indispensable platform.
Yeah, that quote where he said he'd happily host OpenAI, Anthropic, Google's Gemini, anyone really on Azure, that signals a fundamental change from the previous friction we heard about. We know that at one point, that internal fighting got so bad that OpenAI reportedly even considered going to antitrust regulator just to break out of the contract.
Exactly. And Microsoft is actively building, technological independence for its own co-pilot assistant. They're even using cutting-edge AI models from OpenAI's rival, Anthropic, in their 365 tools. So the strategic focus for Microsoft now is clearly resilience and diversification. They want their customers to use the best models out there, whoever built them, but they want it running on their cloud. That position makes them pretty be indispensable, regardless of which specific AI model eventually wins the performance race.
Okay, so if we look across the AI landscape, NVIDIA seems to be matching those massive platform-building investments. Their recent spending spree, it really shows a chip maker actively securing its position at, like, every single layer of the AI ecosystem. Infrastructure, networking, the whole stack.
Their investment activity is just staggering, yeah. It's cementing their position as the dominant hardware provider, no question. The immediate headline is NVIDIA's $1 billion investment in Nokia, buying a 2.9% stake. And that immediately boosted Nokia's stock by a huge 21%. This isn't just, you know, a financial play. It's a direct strategic collaboration. They're focusing on AI networking solutions, incorporating Nokia's data center tech, their switching and optical stuff, right into NVIDIA's future AI infrastructure plans.
It really feels like every other week there's some new massive investment figure attached to Jensen Huang. We have to remember, this Nokia deal comes after earlier investments this year, including that $5 billion pledge to Intel and those, well, jaw-dropping plans for potentially up to $100 billion in open AI infrastructure build-out.
That potential $100 billion plan, it's intended to allow OpenAI to build and deploy, I think the figure was, at least 10 gigawatts of NVIDIA systems. I mean, this immense spending really underpins the entire AI boom. And when you look at NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang, he's also using these investments to position his company politically.
That's where the rhetoric gets interesting, doesn't it? During a keynote, Huang was notably praising President Trump's America First policies and the manufacturing shift. He showed off that huge 3,000-pound Grace Blackwell NVL72 GPU server rack, called it a thinking machine mostly made in U.S. factories. It was really boasting that they're manufacturing in America again, with Blackwell starting in Arizona.
But, you know, if the core, the really highest value step, that advanced packaging piece, is still happening exclusively in Taiwan, how seriously should we take that America First rhetoric? Or is that mostly about securing government subsidies, you think? We really need to pay attention to the manufacturing nuance here because it highlights a pretty significant strategic vulnerability for the whole U.S. tech sector.
Explain that nuance for us. Why is that advanced packaging process such a critical sort of strategic choke point?
Okay, so while the first silicon wafers for those Blackwell GPUs are indeed rolling off the lines at TSMC's plant in Phoenix, that's Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, the final absolutely critical step often happens overseas. Advanced packaging, like TSMC's chip-on-wafer-on-substrate or CoWoS technology, it's essential for linking multiple chiplets. Those are the small individual pieces of silicon into one single high-performance system, like that giant Blackwell rack. If you can't connect those chiplets with extreme precision, well, you just can't build a state-of-the-art AI accelerator. And that technology is still predominantly, often exclusively, available only at TSMC's most advanced fabs in Taiwan. So despite the U.S. wafer starts, the key bottleneck for top-tier AI performance, it remains firmly in Asia.
Hmm. This combination, then, of intense corporate evolution and just massive spending leads us straight to the third point in this section, which is the immediate and, frankly, painful human consequence of AI adoption, this white-collar layoff wave.
Yeah, this is maybe the toughest part of the news to digest today because it's directly affecting tens of thousands of experienced, often highly paid individuals. We're seeing what executives are actually calling a leaner new normal emerge for U.S. employment, and it represents a kind of structural displacement of cognitive labor that feels fundamentally different from just, you know, a cyclical economic downturn.
We have some startling specifics from the journal. Amazon cutting 14,000 corporate jobs. That could be up to 10% of their white-collar workforce. UPS reducing its management ranks by about 14,000 positions over 22 months. Target cutting 1,800 corporate roles. We're also seeing cuts at Molson Coors, Rivian, General Motors, and even the consulting firm Booz Allen. I mean, this is widespread retrenchment across major employers, all focused on administrative and managerial efficiency.
And what's particularly unsettling, I think, is that the main driver behind this wave isn't necessarily shrinking revenue. It's companies embracing artificial intelligence. Executives are openly saying they expect AI can handle much of the work previously done by well-compensated staff, particularly in fields like, say, accounting, HR, fraud monitoring. Investors are now actively pushing the C-suite for greater efficiency, specifically with fewer highly paid employees.
It feels like the technology is just outpacing the skill set of many experienced workers, especially those kind of stuck in the middle of the corporate structure. For instance, there's this CEO, Mike Hoffman of SBI. He cut his software developers by 80%, but saw a productivity surge.
Yeah.
Why? Because their AI now manages clusters of other AI agents doing the actual coding. Their AI, quote, writes its own Python. I mean, this isn't just some incremental shift. It feels like a rapid structural displacement of that specialized middle layer.
And the job market effects are immediate and, frankly, brutal for those caught in it. Tens of thousands of newly laid off white-collar workers are hitting a pretty stagnant market right now. And it's not just the veterans. The college graduates, the class of 2025, they're submitting more job applications but getting fewer offers than the previous year. It really highlights the squeeze on those entry-level positions that are often the first targets for automation.
And nothing brings this home quite like the personal stories, the anecdotes of people caught in this squeeze. We have the, well, devastating story of Chris Reed. He's 33, a 10-year veteran of tech sales in Texas, laid off a year ago.
Reed applied to over 1,000 jobs, couldn't land one in his field, and eventually he had to take a job selling Toyotas. The emotional and financial toll is just immense. To make ends meet, cover basic necessities, he had to empty his 401k, sell stocks, crypto, even Pokemon cards he collected with his son.
Wow. To hear that. The system is truly, as he put it, messed up. He faced foreclosure on his home because he couldn't make mortgage payments. And now he commutes 2 hours or more each way, often works until 9 p.m., sometimes goes days without seeing his kids. His story is just such a powerful illustration of how this economic shift is forcing experienced professionals to basically liquidate their assets just to tread water.
And the stark contrast here is that while management and office jobs are being shredded, opportunities seem to be growing for frontline, blue-collar, or specialized workers. Trades, healthcare, construction, hospitality, they're all reporting shortages. It's a true labor market bifurcation, you know, where the skills needing physical presence or non-automatable expertise are seeing strong demand, while those administrative and mid-level cognitive roles face this intense pressure from technology.
This rapid consolidation of wealth and talent in AI happens against this backdrop of increasing fragility for the average American household. Which brings us right to the biggest anxieties plaguing U.S. domestic policy today, U.S. policy and economic pressures. This is where consumer anxiety is colliding head-on with political gridlock.
Right, and the ongoing government shutdown is really magnifying a major looming domestic crisis, specifically what the Journal is calling ACA sticker shock. Many Affordable Care Act enrollees are just now finding out about absolutely massive premium increases coming in 2026. This crisis puts the fate of crucial federal healthcare subsidies smack in the center of the ongoing government shutdown negotiation.
The data itself is pretty alarming. The average premium increase for those benchmark plans is estimated at 26% next year. That's the total cost rise, driven by rising healthcare spending overall and, critically, the expiration of that temporary federal assistance from the pandemic era.
And again, the real impact is felt in the individual stories. They really illustrate the high stakes. You take Jessica Bunger, a 45-year-old business owner in Florida. Her insurance is set to cost over $1,100 a month without a government subsidy. That's more than four times what she pays now with federal help. And she desperately needs coverage. She has an eye condition that might need surgery to prevent blindness. She told the Journal she was just sick to my stomach when she saw that notice.
That's not just a policy problem. That is a life-changing crisis for a business owner trying to manage complex health needs. Then you have retirees like Clint and Cindy Cottrell in Oregon. Their agent warned them their premium could jump from $300 a month to about $2,500 a month if they keep the same plan once those enhanced subsidies disappear. Clint has muscular dystrophy. Cindy needs regular injections just to walk.
Their dilemma is profound, isn't it? They're now wondering if they can somehow delay planned necessary surgery or even temporarily move overseas where care might be cheaper. They just said they simply can't afford that premium. This financial threat to their basic health security really throws the policy choices being made or not made in Washington into sharp relief.
And this is exactly where the political conflict is rooted. Democrats are pushing hard to extend these enhanced temporary pandemic subsidies. They're hoping the public outcry from angry ACA policyholders will strengthen their hand, basically.
Yeah.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates, what, 3.5 million fewer people will have health coverage by 2027 if these subsidies are allowed to just expire.
Republicans, though, are pushing back. They're citing concerns about the overall long-term cost of the subsidies, potential fraud within the system, and crucially, they're refusing to negotiate the issue while the federal government remains shut down. Some critics also argue, you know, that the expiring subsidies are only responsible for about 3.3% of that total 2026 premium increase. They say the main drivers, accounting for like 83% of the hike, are the structural flaws in the system and rising healthcare costs themselves. suggesting that just extending the subsidy is kind of a band-aid on a deeper problem.
Okay, moving from healthcare policy to monetary policy. The Federal Reserve is facing a really pressing technical decision about its massive asset portfolio. This isn't about setting interest rates directly. It's more about the underlying plumbing of the financial system, right?
Exactly. The Fed has a suddenly quite urgent decision to make, whether to start shrinking its $6.6 trillion asset portfolio sooner than planned, maybe even within days, rather than waiting until year end as they originally intended. This is super technical, but it's incredibly important for market stability.
This revolves around that concept of runoff. The Fed shrinks its balance sheet by just letting securities mature without replacing them. Now, when the Fed originally bought those assets, they created reserves electronic cash that banks hold. So when those assets mature and aren't replaced, that electronic cash drains out of the system.
Precisely. And for the past 3 years, the system had this major cushion, the Money Market Reverse Repurchase Agreement Facility, the RRP. You can think of the RRP as like a massive temporary holding tank for excess cash that sits outside the main banking system. So when the Fed drained cash via runoff, most of it just came out of the RRP, which peaked at, I think, $2.2 trillion. But now that facility is nearly empty. And the crucial implication is, with that cushion gone, every dollar that rolls off the Fed's balance sheet now comes straight out of bank reserves.
And the market is already showing signals that these reserves are moving less freely, suggesting the system's getting tighter.
Yeah, overnight funding markets have firmed up. That's partly due to government debt issuance pulling cash out. This has nudged the benchmark federal funds rate a bit higher within its target range, which is 4% to 4.25%. That little nudge upwards, that's kind of the proximity alert going off.
Because the risk is repeating what happened back in September 2019, right? When the Fed accidentally drained too many reserves, caused overnight lending rates to spike, and then had to do this confusing U-turn.
Exactly. Lou Crandall, chief economist at Wrights and Eiske, put it quite vividly, saying, proximity alerts are going off in the cockpit. They want to avoid a situation where banks suddenly have to, quote, scramble around looking for nickels and dimes in the couch to cover their reserve positions, as one Fed governor apparently said. The whole debate is about ensuring they keep smooth, effective control over those short-term interest rates without causing unintended market stress or another messy cleanup.
Okay, so we have healthcare anxiety, technical monetary tensions. Let's broaden out again and look at the overall consumer and housing outlook. How are average people reacting to all these pressures?
Well, consumer sentiment ticked a bit lower in October, according to the Conference Board survey. It dropped to 94.6 from 95.6 in September. And the reasons cited were renewed trade tensions and, unsurprisingly, the extended government shutdown weighing on people's minds. What's maybe more worrying for the economy is the expectations index. That dropped to 71.5. Historically, readings below 80 often signal a possible recession ahead, reflecting this kind of generalized anxiety about the future.
On the labor front, though, we did get a slight positive sign emerging from losses.
Yes, ADP reported the private sector added roughly 14,250 jobs in the 4 weeks ending October 11th. It's slow, but it's an emergence from that September trough where 32,000 private sector jobs were actually shed. This ADP report gives us a timely kind of snapshot of the market while the official government stats are on hold during the shutdown.
And finally, the housing market. Still cooling off.
Definitely still cooling under the weight of high mortgage rates. The S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index showed the annual price rise slowed to just 1.5% through August. That's the slowest annual increase in over 2 years. It directly reflects the fact that high borrowing costs are really crimping demand and making inventory unaffordable for a lot of potential new buyers.
So it's a really complex, quite mixed economic picture, isn't it? You've got these corporate AI booms coexisting with job market anxiety, healthcare sticker shock, and a slowing housing market. Okay, let's pivot now to global flashpoints, where it seems President Trump is kind of rewriting the script on engagement with major adversaries.
Yeah, the biggest story here is definitely President Trump's new diplomatic approach with China. I mean, he spent his first term basically blowing up the U.S.'s decades-long engagement strategy, but now he seems to be relaunching a form of engagement, though very much on his own transactional terms. This has culminated in a framework agreement reached by top trade negotiators, basically setting the table for a potentially major deal with Xi Jinping when they meet in South Korea on Thursday.
And this framework is being described as kind of transactional truce with immediate economic consequences. What are the main pieces of this agreement?
Well, potentially, it involves China resuming large purchases of U.S. soybeans. That's a key concession clearly aimed at appeasing the American farm belt. Beijing also apparently agreed to delay new controls on rare earth minerals, you know, a sector China dominates and often uses as a strategic lever. In return, the U.S. is considering shelving new tariffs and maybe significantly rolling back that 20% tariff it imposed on China over its role in the fentanyl crisis.
Let's dig into that fentanyl aspect a bit more. That seems like a major and politically very sensitive concession for the U.S. side.
It really is. The U.S. expects to lower its 20% fentanyl-related tariff on Chinese goods by as much as 10 percentage points. In exchange, China is expected to commit to stricter controls on those precursor chemicals used to make fentanyl, the synthetic opioid, behind hundreds of thousands of overdose deaths in the U.S. If that tariff is lowered to 10%, it would bring the average tariff on most Chinese imports much closer to those on goods from other sort of non-aligned trading partners. It would essentially de-escalate the trade war quite significantly.
What are the broader strategic implications of this shift? It feels like a pretty sudden cooling of tensions after years of really heated rhetoric and action.
Well, for China, this detente provides a crucial window of stability. It lets Beijing focus more intensely on its persistent domestic economic slowdown without the constant threat of new U.S. sanctions hanging over them. Analysts tend to view this as tactical, though not structural reform. Daniel Bahar, a former U.S. trade official, suggested the truce won't really change the long-term trajectory of U.S.-China competition, but rather just buy time for each side to continue to de-risk from the other. For Trump, of course, it gives him a platform to project that image as a master dealmaker who can bring rivals to the table.
And this agreement is just the first step, right? Part of a newly structured high-level dialogue meant to lock in a full year of leader-led diplomacy.
That seems to be the plan. We're looking at a pretty ambitious schedule, apparently, with Trump expected to travel to Beijing early next year, followed by a reciprocal visit from Xi later that year. This kind of structured approach definitely contrasts with the often ad hoc and unpredictable nature of their meetings during his first term.
So Beijing gets some breathing room.
Exactly. Beijing sees this as achieving a near-term goal, basically a strategic stalemate, where American pressure becomes manageable. The concessions they're making seem tactical, designed to appease Trump, you know, without really addressing those core structural issues like IP theft, forced tech transfer, or massive state subsidies, which the U.S. still fundamentally objects to.
Okay, moving from the biggest superpower rivalry to key alliances, President Trump also met with the new Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, aboard the USS George Washington. That was clearly aimed at projecting stability in the region.
Yeah, that meeting was all about reinvigorating the alliance, with a clear focus on defense and supply chain security. The leaders pledged to boost security cooperation, and significantly, the U.S. approved the sale of a first batch of F-35 missiles to Japan. That's a big deal. It directly boosts Japan's long-range deterrence capabilities.
And critically, they signed a pact to work together on securing rare earths and other critical minerals. Why are these minerals so vital that they warrant a high-level strategic pact like this?
Well, rare earths are absolutely essential components in pretty much all high-tech and defense manufacturing. Everything from, you know, iPhones and electric car batteries to F-35 jets and sophisticated missile guidance systems relies on them. And since China currently dominates the global supply chain for processing these minerals, the U.S. and Japan are making a strategic move here. They've agreed to map new deposits, build up stockpiling reserves, and invest in new processing and refining facilities outside of China's control. This kind of show of force and strategic cooperation sends a powerful message of reassurance across the region.
We should also note, apparently Takaichi's appointment has complicated things for the Bank of Japan regarding interest rates.
Yes. Takaichi is known as a pretty hawkish advocate of expansive economic policy, sort of Abenomics plus. That's led investors to believe rate increases might be pushed back further, even with persistent inflation. Most analysts, though, still expect the BOJ to keep its policy rate steady at 0.5% this week.
Okay, finally, in the global arena, we have several really hot spots that demand attention. Let's start with the Gaza ceasefire situation, which sounds like it might be collapsing already.
Yeah, that fragile peace deal is under severe strain. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered what he called forceful strikes in the Gaza Strip. This was after Israel alleged that Hamas violated the ceasefire by shooting at Israeli troops in Israeli-controlled territory in southern Gaza.
Hamas predictably denies this.
Yes. Hamas claims Israel is just using these allegations as a pretext to restart the war, and they deny any connection to the shooting incident. We also saw some concerning reports that Israel accused Hamas of staging the recovery of partial remains of a deceased hostage, which just adds more layers of complexity and deep distrust to any information coming out of that zone right now.
And President Trump, while on his way to South Korea, issued a pretty stark warning about Hamas, saying that if they're not good, quote, their lives will be terminated. But critics of Netanyahu are suggesting that coordinating closely with the Americans, who want, you know, proportional responses to keep the truce alive, severely limits Israel's ability to act forcefully against what they see as violations without risking a complete diplomatic break.
Shifting to Africa now, we see escalating violence in Sudan and some deeply concerning allegations of external meddling, specifically involving a key U.S. partner.
U.S. intelligence agencies are alleging that the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, is sending increasing supplies of weapons to the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF militia, in Sudan. That's the group accused of genocide. The weapons allegedly include advanced Chinese-made drones, small arms, heavy machine guns, basically bolstering a group that's fueled one of the world's absolute worst humanitarian crises. The UAE, for its part, strongly denies these claims.
It really highlights a complex geopolitical reality, doesn't it? The UAE is a key U.S. partner. They anchored the Abraham Accords, provided support for the Gaza peace plan. Yet they're simultaneously seen as quietly projecting power to influence regional conflicts when it serves their economic interests. Things like securing access to Sudan's vast gold resources and ports. The war there, now 2 years old, has killed possibly up to 150,000 people and left one of Africa's largest countries just poised to become a failed state.
And finally, moving closer to home, to the Americas, we see a really dramatic expansion of the U.S. drug war campaign escalating into actual military action.
Yeah, the U.S. carried out lethal strikes on four vessels allegedly operated by drug smugglers in the Eastern Pacific, killing 14 people. This action, which Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth described as targeting narco-terrorists, has for the first time drawn Mexico's military into the campaign by essentially crossing established boundaries of military action against drug groups.
And Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has officially requested the incident be discussed with the U.S. ambassador, right? To ensure international treaties are being followed.
That's right. This campaign, which has reportedly killed at least 57 people and 13 strikes since early September, involves high-level military assets like bomber flights and even aircraft carrier strike groups. It signals a very significant escalation of military force against drug cartels, which is a threat, you might remember, Trump previously raised regarding potential unilateral action inside Mexico.
Wow. That is a staggering amount of geopolitical movement. We've talked about global structure, economic structure. Let's drill down now into some specific corporate battles and regulatory scrutiny that are reshaping several industries right here at home.
Okay, we have to start with UPS. Despite reporting lower third quarter profit and revenue compared to last year, they actually managed to beat analyst expectations, and that sent their stock up 8%. This performance seems directly linked to some massive, really aggressive cost-saving measures.
And when we say cost-saving measures, we mean huge, previously undisclosed job cuts, apparently.
Exactly. UPS disclosed they've cut 48,000 management and operations jobs this year. Now, that's significantly more than the 20,000 operational jobs they had previously announced. These cuts have resulted in cost savings of about $2.2 billion so far this year, and they're targeting $3.5 billion in total year-over-year savings in 2025.
And this immediately connects to an opinion piece mentioned in the journal, which frames these cuts as the inevitable result of Teamsters chief Sean O'Brien's bad bargain. The argument being made there is that the high labor costs mandated in the new contract, which raised average compensation for full-time drivers to around $170,000 a year, or about $80 an hour, put UPS at a severe competitive disadvantage, especially against non-union rivals like FedEx. And that, therefore, forced these massive layoffs and management cuts.
Right. The Teamsters union had insisted the contract required UPS to create 30,000 jobs. But the company apparently only committed to giving part-time employees the chance to apply for full-time openings. If job openings are then reduced by 48,000, well, those opportunities just vanish, don't they? It really highlights that eternal tension. When labor leaders, arguably, ignore the competitive viability of their employers in a highly competitive market, often the most vulnerable workers end up suffering the consequences through automation and cuts.
Okay, next up, regulatory scrutiny hitting Kenvue, the maker of Tylenol. This comes in the form of a major lawsuit from the Texas Attorney General.
Yeah, Texas AG Ken Paxton sued Kenvue, alleging deceptive marketing, specifically advertising the pain reliever as safe during pregnancy, despite research showing an inconclusive yet concerning link between the active ingredient, acetaminophen, and autism.
This sounds like a really complex legal and medical situation, putting consumers in a tough spot.
It is complex. Studies looking at the link between acetaminophen and autism are inconclusive. Medical societies, doctors, researchers, they consistently recommend acetaminophen as the best, safest option for treating fever and pain during pregnancy, mainly because unchecked fever poses a known greater risk to the fetus. Kenview called the lawsuit's claims baseless and basically reaffirmed the safety of acetaminophen, citing the global medical community's consensus.
But this lawsuit follows an official warning issued by President Trump and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. back in September, didn't it? Citing existing studies, implanting label updates, and an awareness campaign about this potential link.
That's right. So the Texas suit is seeking significant civil penalties and wants clear warnings about autism on Tylenol's labels. Kenview, it should be noted, has so far successfully fought off hundreds of similar lawsuits filed since 2022 by plaintiffs' attorneys.
Okay, finally, in the realm of corporate entertainment, we have a major Hollywood defection. This signals a pretty significant shift in power dynamics at Paramount. Looks like they're losing their golden goose.
We are talking about Taylor Sheridan, yeah. The creator of the massively successful Yellowstone franchise. He's leaving Paramount for NBC Universal in a 5-year deal potentially worth up to $1 billion. That's definitely a black eye for Paramount's new leadership under CEO David Ellison, especially coming after the Skydance merger.
Sheridan was arguably Paramount's most valuable asset, right? He was instrumental in putting Paramount Plus on the map. His shows cost an absolutely astounding amount, over $500 million a year to produce. That spinoff 1923 apparently cost $22 million per episode. But under Ellison's new leadership, Sheridan reportedly felt the leash tightening, as the Journal put it.
Yeah, the friction points were specific and quite telling about the shift in corporate culture there. The new regime started questioning his, well, exorbitant spending. They rejected a film script he pitched, despite his strong track record writing films like Sicario and Hell or High Water. And they apparently offered suggestions for new TV shows that kind of put him off. He also felt disrespected, apparently, when Paramount tapped Nicole Kidman for a new legal drama without telling him, potentially disrupting his production schedule for his own successful series, Lioness.
So beyond the personal slight, what's the strategic implication for Paramount? I mean, does losing one creator, even one as prolific as Sheridan, truly jeopardize a massive streaming service? Or does it signal maybe a fundamental shift away from the expensive, singular showrunner model altogether?
Well, it signals a massive risk for Paramount, I'd say, even if they do want to move away from that high-cost creator model. Sheridan's universe was their absolute tentpole. Ellison clearly felt the previous leadership was too differential, maybe prioritizing relationships over cost control. But that move cost him one of the most prolific creators in television history. Sheridan plans to stay involved with his current Paramount shows until his deal ends in 2029, but he'll start making movies for NBCU as early as next year. It's just a really delicate balance, isn't it? Trying to foster top-tier talent while simultaneously keeping corporate control and managing costs. Ellison chose control, it seems, and paid a potentially billion-dollar price.
Okay, from the corporate boardroom, let's step into the home now, where we explore the new technological frontiers and how they're impacting our everyday culture. We have to talk about the impending invasion of humanoid robots designed for domestic use.
Yeah, this is the stuff of science fiction finally becoming, well, a concrete commercial reality. We're talking about Neo. A 5'6", 66-pound humanoid robot from a company called 1X Technologies. And it's specifically designed to be a house cleaner, perform domestic chores.
And you can pre-order Neo now for $20,000. Or rent it for $499 a month with a 6-month minimum. Delivery expected in 2026.
But there's a huge, immediate, and kind of hidden cost here, isn't there? Beyond the price tag. Privacy.
Absolutely. For now, Neo is primarily controlled by a human teleoperator wearing a VR headset. The company calls them a human puppet master. Which means to get your chores done efficiently, you basically have to be, quote, cool with a company representative potentially peering through the robot's camera eyes right into your private living space. The goal is full autonomy, sure, but for now, the AI brain is learning from constant human teleoperation. It essentially turns your home into a training lab.
The company insists there are crucial safety features built in, though. They do. Neo is designed to be provably safe, they say. It's lightweight, uses synthetic tendons to limit the force it can exert, and initially it won't handle anything hot, heavy, or sharp. They had to prioritize safety because apparently earlier versions had some issues, including one that face-planted while trying to do tasks.
Not ideal for cleaning the fine china.
Not ideal, no. The 1X CEO, Bernd Burnisch, acknowledged the quality of autonomous work might lag at first, but he expects it will improve drastically as they gather more data, which of course means more video feeds of your private space being used to train their neural network. This shift really represents the dawn of physical AI moving into our most private spaces. It creates a whole new kind of social contract and raises immediate questions about digital security right there in the home.
Okay, moving from the robot revolution to how people are actually using existing AI tools, we're seeing some surprising adoption among older generations. It kind of challenges that assumption that only younger adults are really engaging with this tech.
Yes, that perception that AI is just for the young seems incorrect. A Pew Research Center report found that 19% of people 65 and older use AI several times a day. Now, while that's lower than younger adults, about a third or more use it, that often the ways seniors are leveraging AI show incredible utility for managing complex financial and personal tasks.
The practical applications are really fascinating. For investing, there's Dan Spohr, a 69-year-old retired aerospace executive. He now uses ChatGPT to produce cash flow analyses and compare price-to-earnings ratios. He says it saves him hours of tedious spreadsheet work. He calls it a problem-solving tool, not just, you know, a simple search engine.
And for everyday life stuff, Cynthia Lieberman, 67, used AI to scale a massive Thanksgiving menu for 22 people. She just uploaded her existing recipes and got back a full prep schedule and an aisle-sorted grocery list. Saved considerable time and mental effort, she said. Others are using it for troubleshooting. Noah Littman, 66, used ChatGPT to figure out how to get a specific display on his heart monitor watch in like 2 seconds, avoiding a long, frustrating search through YouTube tutorials.
And Bill Groner, a 70-year-old retired litigator, even uses it for home repairs he used to pay a plumber $150 for, and to develop step-by-step health plans, like increasing protein intake tailored specifically to his medical profile.
But, and this is important, there are cautions, which are critical for any user, really, regardless of age. We still have that persistent problem of hallucinations. Barry Schwimmer, 68, got an itinerary from ChatGPT that hilariously had him on a connecting flight before his initial flight had even landed, shows that human oversight is still absolutely essential.
Right, don't trust it blindly. And there's the psychological drawback, too, the flattery thing.
Yeah, chatbots can be overly flattering or, as experts put it, kind of seductive. As Schwimmer noted, AI becomes seductive when it tells you you're the smartest person because you caught a mistake. Experts warn this sycophancy is a known issue, especially maybe for vulnerable people who could experience delusions or become overly reliant on the bot's positive feedback loop.
And a final crucial safety tip mentioned.
Yes, if you're using AI for sensitive health issues, users really should utilize the chatbot's incognito mode. This prevents the query from being saved to your account and potentially used to train the model. It protects against possible future discrimination based on medical history that could, theoretically, be inadvertently scraped from your queries down the line.
Okay, that brings us to a more mundane but extremely relatable cultural battle, the fight against meeting distractions. Bosses are apparently losing it over employees constantly checking phones and laptops during corporate get-togethers.
Oh, yeah, this is a pervasive issue. It spans from startups right up to massive financial institutions. Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky admitted that even he is guilty of zoning out sometimes, saying it's a huge problem. And JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon is equally frustrated, apparently telling employees glued to their devices to just close the damn thing.
Some companies are trying pretty extreme measures to fight this modern condition.
They are. UTHealth, a healthcare system, tried hiding the Wi-Fi password for an off-site retreat. And surprisingly, they said it led to better, more focused conversation. Another proposal floating around is instituting a kind of lighthearted corporate equivalent of a swear jar, maybe levying a small fine for visible phones during meetings.
But employees push back, saying it's more complex than just being rude.
Right. They correctly point out the complexity. They're often expected to be connected 24/7. And sometimes that parallel communication texting colleagues to quickly compare notes, pull up data, or relay info is actually necessary in modern, flattened hierarchies. Some CEOs managing remote meetings even said they appreciate a colleague texting LTP, short for land the plane, if they're going on too long about something.
So ultimately, leaders like Chesky are opting not to bring in new strict rules, but rather try to reset the culture by setting better examples themselves.
Exactly. They're acknowledging that the issue isn't really the phone itself, but maybe the amount of time we all stare at them and the expectation of always being available. It's really a reflection of modern work, isn't it? The tools aren't inherently bad, but their overuse is symptomatic of this always-on culture that's just blurred all the boundaries between work and well, being present.
Okay, let's wrap up our deep dive today with a couple of compelling segments from the world of sports and some political drama spilling over into it. We had an absolute marathon of a game in the World Series this week.
Oh, man. Game 3 of the World Series between the LA Dodgers and the Toronto Blue Jays. It lasted 6 hours and 39 minutes, tied the record for the longest World Series game ever, 18 innings. It was just the true spectacle of attrition, forcing managers to completely empty their benches and their bullpens.
And the entire game seemed to revolve around one player, Shohei Ohtani. He had this slugging performance for the ages, slammed 4 extra base hits, 2 doubles, 2 homers, apparently a feat not seen in the World Series since 1906.
Yeah, and the Blue Jays manager, John Schneider, made this very clear tactical decision. Ohtani was not going to be the reason his team lost, no matter what the criticism. Ohtani was intentionally walked 4 times in a row, 5 times overall, from the 9th inning all the way to the 17th. That set a postseason record for intentional walks and just forced the Dodgers to rely on the rest of their lineup.
And the end finally came when Freddie Freeman hit a walk-off homer in the bottom of the 18th. It also had some pretty bizarre moments showing the exhaustion, like a reliever, Will Klein, throwing 72 pitches over 4 innings, and the starting pitcher from 2 days earlier, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, apparently lobbying to warm up to pitch the 19th if needed.
Truly a wacky, unforgettable game. But on a far more serious note, we have the continuing fallout from the NBA gambling scandal involving the former player Damon Jones.
Right. Jones, who was a former journeyman NBA player and later an assistant coach, has been accused of funneling inside information to sports bettors. His case is linked to this sweeping federal investigation into an illegal gambling ring.
Prosecutors allege Jones was used as a face card, essentially, in mafia-linked rigged poker games, leveraging his access to the league's biggest stars. Jones, who was known to be a longtime friend of LeBron James. James is referred to as Player 3 in the indictment. Allegedly used this proximity to the star to gain financial advantage.
And the most incriminating evidence seems to be a text message sent in February 2023, just before a Lakers game against the Milwaukee Bucks.
That's the one. Jones allegedly texted bettors, "Get a big bet on Milwaukee tonight before the information is out." Apparently he had learned James would be sidelined with an ankle injury. James was listed as questionable, but was then declared out shortly after, and the Lakers lost the game. It's important to note, James himself is not accused of any wrongdoing, and reportedly hasn't even spoken with Jones in 2 years.
Still, the indictment paints a pretty disturbing picture, doesn't it? Of Jones allegedly willing to trade his access to the NBA's inner circle for profit. It really highlights the vulnerability of the league to insider information and the huge stakes involved now with professional sports betting being so widespread.
Absolutely.
Okay, we have covered a huge amount of ground today. From those structural shifts in the AI economy, driving massive white-collar job cuts and corporate valuations, to this very transactional geopolitics playing out, and these deep domestic anxieties over healthcare costs and financial stability here in the U.S.
The connections are really impossible to ignore, aren't they? The same technological forces concentrating wealth in companies like Microsoft and NVIDIA are at the same time destabilizing the career path for the typical American office worker. Meanwhile, essential domestic concerns like those healthcare subsidies and the Fed financial plumbing are facing intense pressure amid political gridlock and just general economic fear.
I want to end with one final provocative thought for you, our listener, to consider. A contrast that starkly frames the current moment, perhaps. Amidst all this reporting we've discussed today, consumer anxiety, economic scarcity, the ongoing government shutdown President Trump is apparently moving ahead with plans to tear down the White House's East Wing to build a massive 90,000 square foot ballroom. That's nearly twice the size of the White House's main building itself. And he also fired all the members of the Commission of Fine Arts who might have reviewed those plans.
Yeah, that focus on personal ambition and, well, pageantry, spending $350 million raised from private donors. It stands in pretty sharp contrast with the day's reporting on families facing these quadruple-digit ACA premium hikes, or experienced professionals like Chris Reed emptying their 401ks just to get by.
It seems the very definition of private wealth, connecting back to those corporate booms we talked about, is funding these grand projects. While the system designed to support average citizens like the ACA is facing political gridlock over comparatively far smaller amounts of public money, does this contrast these grand personal building projects versus widespread economic fragility and political paralysis, does it signal a fundamental shift in what the public expects or maybe should expect from political leadership?
It certainly raises the question of whether our nation is prioritizing spectacle over substance or service, something to definitely mull over as these interconnected stories continue to unfold.
Indeed. We encourage you to reflect on how all these threads weave together and where that leaves the average American. Thank you for joining us for the Deep Dive.